Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Bhagavatam, Canto 9, Chapter 5, Durvasa Muni's Life Spared. Text 23 and 24, and we're reading 24. Gate tar durvasa si sombarisho. Dvijo payoga ti pavitra maharat. Visher vimoksham vyasanam cha viksha. Mene swaviryam cha paranubhavam. Translation. After 1 year, when Durvasa Muni had returned, King Ambarish sumptuously fed him all varieties of pure food, and then he himself also ate. When the king saw the Brahmana, Durvasa, had been released from the great danger of being burned, he could understand that by the grace of the Lord, he himself was also powerful. But he did not take any credit, for everything had been done by the Lord. Please repeat. After 1 year, purport by his divine grace, Srila Prabhupada. Jai. And jai to you for saying jai Prabhupada. Jai. So purport by Srila Prabhupada. A devotee like Maharaj Ambarish is certainly always busy in many activities. Of course, this material world is full of dangers that one has to meet. But a devotee, because of his full dependence on the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is never disturbed. The vivid example is Maharaj Ambarish. He was the emperor of the entire world and had many duties to perform. And in the course of these duties, there were many disturbances created by persons like Durvasa Muni. But the king tolerated everything, patiently depending fully on the mercy of the Lord. The Lord, however, is situated in everyone's heart, and he manages things as he desires. Thus, although Maharaj Ambarish was faced with many disturbances, the Lord, being merciful to him, managed things so nicely that in the end, Durvasa Muni and Maharaj Ambarish became great friends and parted cordially on the basis of bhakti yoga. After all, Durvasa Muni was convinced of the power of bhakti yoga, although he himself was a great mystic yogi. Therefore, as stated by Lord Krishna in Bhagavad Gita 6:47, yoginam api sarvesham, of all yogis, he who always abides in me with great faith, worshipping me in transcendental loving service, is most intimately united with me in yoga and is the highest of all. Thus, it is a fact that a devotee is the topmost yogi, as proved in the dealings of Maharaj Ambarish with Durvasa Muni. Oh, bad ki jai, Hannibal. Lots and lots of important points been made, both in the translation and purports as ever, commenting on Krishnanand Prabhu's little introduction in Prasadam. We see here that King Ambarish sumptuously fed him all varieties of pure food. So very important that we make sure we maintain, both for ourselves and for people that we distribute to, good quality, and both materially and also spiritually, good quality prasadam. We know that you are what you eat. So everything that we put in this little, or in my case, big, gap in our face here, called our mouth, everything we put in has an effect on our consciousness. And that's why it's stressed time and time again throughout Shastra that we should always only partake of prasadam like that, and avoid all foods that are unofferable, but then also avoid all foods that are offerable but haven't actually been offered like that. We should do that to the very best of our ability to remain pure in mind and heart. And also then, in the translation, we read that when the king saw that the Brahman, had been released from the great danger of being burned, because we know the story, and the Sudarshan disc was chasing Durvasa all around, and Durvasa was running everywhere. It's kind of funny, it's described, he's running everywhere. So he tries to run into a cave to hide, and he tries to run here and there, and Prabhupada says here and there, and everywhere he's trying to run to avoid the Sudarshan chakra. Then he goes to, is it Lord Brahma or Lord Shiva first? He goes to one of them, and then the other. And they also can't protect him. And eventually he goes to Lord Vishnu, and then Lord Vishnu says he also can't protect him. You know, the only thing that can protect you from this is that you receive the forgiveness of the devotee that you've offended. And that devotee will request that. So here it's saying that because Maharaj Ambarish is seeing that that's what happened, that's the reality of what happened, that he himself then, by dint of that, you know, for instance, if we take ourselves, if on our behalf, you know, the Sudarshan chakra is chasing somebody, whoever that might be, whoever might have offended you recently or in the past, and somehow or other, because of you're so dear to Lord Krishna, you're so dear to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, that his Sudarshan form is chasing that person all over the universe. That's one amazing thing, that you're so dear to Lord Krishna that that's actually happening. But then the second amazing thing is that on your command, so to speak, or on your request, it's not a command actually, it's much more a request from Maharaj Ambarish, on your request, the Sudarshan chakra stops. So you can see how that would could potentially affect us. We could think, hey, whew, I'm a pretty powerful guy, you know. If someone offends me, you know, the Sudarshan chakra starts chasing him. And then if I say, stop, Sudarshan, you know, the Sudarshan chakra stops. So, you know, you can see how we could become carried away with that. And of course, in the third chapter of Bhagavad Gita, we read Prakrite Kriyamanane Gunan Karmani Savasha Hankara, false ego. This is all, that mentality would all be out of false ego. But Maharaj Ambarish here, he's understanding, he's not getting carried away, or he's not getting puffed up, because he's understanding that it's exclusively by the grace of the Lord that he had any shakti or he had any power like that. It's all coming from the grace of Krishna. So what's the result of that when we actually understand that and realize that to be the true position? The result of that is that we don't take credit. How hard is it to not take credit in the material world for things that, quote-unquote, we do? Certainly, you know, it's relatively easy to pay lip service to that. When someone says, oh, Prabhu, you know, that was really good what you did. And you say, oh, no, that was your mercy, or that was Krishna's mercy, or that was so-and-so's mercy. I didn't. So that's okay. We're quite able to do that. But in our heart, you know, and in our minds, with our intelligence, that we genuinely understand this principle, actually, of the fact that we're not the doer, or at least the contribution that we make to the act, whatever the act may be, the contribution we make is quite minimal in terms of being the doer. So it's actually really understanding that, deep-rooted understanding that, and not taking any credit. That's not such an easy thing. That's something that we have to really work on, and something that we have to both study and also pray, you know, for Krishna's mercy and the mercy of the devotees, mercy of Srila Prabhupada, that we can understand that. But here Maharaj Ambarish, he's fully understanding that, and therefore he's taking no credit. Why? Because he understands that everything has been done by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So that's in the translation. And then in the purport, first we read that this material world is full of dangers. Padam padam yadvipadam, we read in Srimad Bhagavatam that the material world is danger at every step. And I have a little story, if you can remind me. I don't want to tell it now, actually, because I just want to go through the purport. But just in case I forget, I have a little story related to padam padam yadvipadam, danger at every step, that I'll tell a little later, that really encapsulates that point, that there's danger at every step. Because in one sense, again, we understand, yes, the material world is a place of danger. But when we're young, I'm looking at some of you in front of me, you know, and what to speak of that little fella sitting in front of you. You know, very young, and it's kind of difficult sometimes to transfer that philosophy, that theory, into practice. You know, we're young, we're fit, we're strong, you know, and we're thinking danger every step. Hey, you know, I can take on those dangers. And so I'll tell a little story later on that really encapsulates that. And later here in the purport, we're reading... there's one point I wanted to highlight. Yes, that both Durvasa Muni and Maharaj Ambarish, they became great friends after all of this. They actually became, by the power of Bhakti Yoga, they became great friends. So whatever their differences were, whatever those... And actually, you know, I think in an earlier purport or in a translation, I think Durvasa Muni accepts, he's talking to Maharaj Ambarish, and he accepts actually that he says, I didn't realize how wonderful you were, how special you were, and that's why I took offense. But of course, as devotees, we're not really meant to take offense ever at anything like that. And no matter who the person is or what the situation is. So Durvasa here was making a kind of material calculation. You know, I just thought you were an ordinary guy, therefore I took offense at what you... Now I realize you were a great guy, oh, I shouldn't have taken an offense. So the implication is, if you were an ordinary guy, then what I did was okay. And of course, what he did was, I mean, you know, Maharaj Ambarish really went out of his way. It wasn't as though, you know, he was performing everything perfectly, and he was waiting, and he hadn't eaten, and, you know, he was waiting for Durvasa to come back. Durvasa sort of got absorbed in his meditation, etc., and he was coming back late, and Maharaj Ambarish was thinking, well, it's an offense to eat when you've already invited a guest to eat like that. But if I don't break the Ekadashi on Dwadashi on time, then that's also an offense. So what to do? And he went and consulted Brahmins. And the Brahmins, you know, the conclusion was best to take some water, because by taking water, you're simultaneously fasting and not fasting at the same time. Just like, you know, on Jamastami, of days that we fast, drinking water, you know, it's not actually breaking the... It's simultaneously Chinta Veda Veda Tattva, but it's not actually breaking the fast. So here, this was the advice that Maharaj Ambarish got from the Brahmins. This is what you should do. And, you know, any normal, sane person, when you're reading that, you think, wow, Maharaj Ambarish is a really fantastic personality. He's really going the extra mile to make sure he does nothing wrong. And therefore, he broke his fast by taking water. Wow. You know, it's like, wow. I mean, big deal. It wasn't that he sat down to a big plate of cheese subji and samosas and sweet rice and all that, you know. He took a little bit of water, you know. But then, because Durvasa was a great muni, he knew this, even though he wasn't there. And then he takes this incredible offense, takes out some of his hair, sets loose this big, angry, fiery demon, you know, because why? Because Maharaj Ambarish racked his brains and heart and soul to figure out how he could satisfy both situations. And then that's the return he got. So, you know, as you're reading that, you're thinking, that's very reasonable, and Durvasa is incredibly unreasonable for the actions that he actually took. But then, because Maharaj Ambarish is a wonderful devotee, that when Durvasa came to him, of course, he only came to him when the Sudarshan Chakra was chasing him all over the universe, you know. it wasn't necessarily, well, it was spontaneous, but it was spontaneous based on a very difficult situation. But Maharaj Ambarish, having such a big heart and being such a wonderful devotee, he immediately, you know, asked Lord Vishnu and asked the Sudarshan Chakra to desist from chasing Durvasa Muni. So now Durvasa Muni says, you know, yeah, I'm very sorry I offended you. I thought you were just an ordinary guy, but no, you're not. You're a really special guy like that. But anyway, they became great friends due to the power of Bhakti Yoga. And the verse that's quoted is Yoginam Api Sarvesham, that of all yogis, one who abides in me has great faith in me. Worshipping me in transcendental loving service is most intimately united with me in yoga and is the highest of all. This theme is repeated throughout the Bhagavad Gita, in many, many verses actually, throughout the Bhagavad Gita. Aham Savasya Prabhuvo, I am the source of all spiritual and material worlds. And one who understands this will engage in pure devotional service. That's what they will do, because they understand that I'm the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Etam Vibhutam Yogam Cha Mamayo Veti Tatvataha. That's 10.7. That's the verse before that, 10.7, 10.8. That How does that start? 10-7, the English. How does it start? Etam Vibhutam Yogam Cha. We don't have a Bhagavad Gita here. I just want to get the first words. They've slipped my mind. No, they're the verses, the next verse. No, I'm looking for the English of Etam Vibhutam Yogam Cha. Anyway, I'll ad-lib it. It's along the lines of one who is factually convinced of this opulence and mystic power of mine, one who's factually convinced of that, they will engage in unalloyed devotional service. Of this there is no doubt. So this is these verses are giving a very, very important message. And basically what these verses are communicating to us is if we understand who Krishna is, and if we accept who Krishna is, and all the wonderful things that Krishna can do. Ah, look at that. One who is factually convinced of this opulence and mystic power of mine engages in unalloyed devotional service. Of this there is no doubt. So I think I actually got it right. That's good. My memory is not as bad as I thought it was. Okay, but these verses are giving a very, very important message that if we're factually convinced of Krishna, we accept that he's the source of all spiritual and material worlds, we accept his opulence and mystic power. And there's another verse, very similar verse, in chapter 15, which I don't know off the top of my head, 15:9, I think. Let me get it. 15:9. No, that's not the verse I was looking for, actually. What am I looking for then? 15:9. Maybe it's 16:9, is it? No. Anyway, sorry about that. But there's another very, very similar verse making the same point, that if we're factually convinced of who Krishna is, we will engage in pure ahoitaki apratihata, uncontaminated and uninterrupted devotional service. So if we're not doing that, if we're not engaged in unalloyed, uninterrupted, uncontaminated, if you like, devotional service, if we're not doing that, then to the degree that we're not actually doing that, then we're not fully convinced of Krishna's position and who Krishna actually is. So if we're not doing that, we should know that there's still a lot of work for us to do in devotional service. Like that, we shouldn't become complacent, just like Durvasa Muni here is becoming complacent in relation to Maharaj Ambarish. And if you analyze and study what goes on in the material world is the haven, the home, the sanctuary of people who have become complacent on this point. We're very fortunate right now, because for whatever reason, we've come in the association of devotees, and we've come in contact with Srila Prabhupada's teachings, and we've come in contact with spiritual life. And therefore, right now, we're trying not to be complacent. But because this is the home of Maya, because it's the home of Maya, then that complacency can kick in again at any point. So we have to be very, very careful. You know, Maya's service, Maya's a devotee of Krishna, like that. What's her service? Her service is essentially to keep the spiritual world pure. She doesn't want to let anybody into the spiritual world who has any tiny scintilla of material desire. So she's performing a wonderful, wonderful service for Krishna, because obviously Krishna is having his wonderful eternal pastimes in the spiritual world. They're happening all the time in the spiritual world, and he doesn't want them to be disturbed or interrupted or affected in any way. So therefore, he's given this service to Maya Devi. You make sure that nobody comes here unless they're 100% pure, so as that they can enter into these pastimes. So that's Maya, what Maya's service is. So for us, we have to become pure so as that Maya will step aside and allow us to enter back into those pastimes. So we can't become complacent. There's no room for complacency. Once we become anyway complacent, Prabhupada told us that spiritual life is like a razor's edge. And we also understand that, you know, spiritual life, material life, our lives, us, nothing's ever static. You're either moving forward or you're moving backwards. You don't really stay the same as such like that. So we always have to be conscious and vigilant that we're progressing in spiritual life by performing nice sadhana, associating nicely with devotees, not committing offenses. We see what happens when we offend devotees. You know, we'll have the Sudarshan chakra chasing after us. So we always must be very vigilant like that. Because as I say, if you analyze the material world, you have people in this material world. There's one book now, I'm sure you've heard of it. It's out a few years. But it's called The God Delusion. And it's a gentleman called Mr. Richard Dawkins, I think. Yeah, it's Dawkins, not Hawkins. Interesting that the two chaps have very similar names, you know. There must be something to that. But anyway, Mr. Dawkins has written a book called, you know, The God Delusion. So we can get ourselves from the position of engaging with Krishna in the spiritual world to the position of engaging with Krishna here in the spiritual world, in Radha Gopinath Mandir. We can have ourselves in that situation, and then we can find ourselves in Mr. Dawkins' situation, where he's writing a book called The God Delusion, trying to convince us all that there's no such thing as God. Krishna's telling us, Ahamsavasya Prabhuvo, I am the source of all spiritual and material worlds. And Mr. Dawkins is telling us, no, he doesn't exist. So, as devotees, we have two things. We have to important that we don't become complacent in our own spiritual life, that we're always progressing. And secondly, that we're convincing people that they should listen to Krishna, not to Mr. Dawkins like that. In essence, the only difference between atheism and theism, really, when you strip it all down and rip it all apart, the only real difference is that the atheists say that everything that we experience, everything that we know, including ourselves and including all our environment and everything around us, they say that everything came from nothing. That's what they say. Whereas the theists, they say everything came from something. Now, in our experience in life, where did we come from? We came from our mother's womb, and our father inseminated our mother. So we came from our mother and father. We came from something. Radha Gopinath Mandir, I was not fortunate enough to be here in the early days. I only came for the first time a few years back when your temple was beautiful like it is now. But I understand that in the early days, it was a dump. I say in a very nice, affectionate way. And then the devotees put lots of hard work and effort and time and money and resources into making it beautiful. And there was some plan. Someone sat down and thought, well, what will the temple room look like? And they designed it like this with these nice little... they remind me of the verse in the Srimad Bhagavatam when Krishna's entering Dwarka and all the residents of Dwarka, particularly the ladies, are up in the higher floors of the buildings looking down and worshipping Krishna from afar. But somebody obviously designed this. It's not that, you know, Gauranga Prabhu just sort of started coming in with some wood and throwing it around the place, you know, and it just all fitted into place like it is now. So someone designed it and put it together. So it came from something. There was a plan. There was a designer. There were people who did the construction. So our experience is that everything came from something, yet they tell us everything came from nothing. That's their philosophy. There's one nice conversation between Srila Prabhupada, and I think it's Virabhu Prabhu. Virabhu, I think, studied science before he became a devotee. And he was saying to Prabhupada that when he was in college and his professor or his teacher would often ridicule those who believed in God and ridicule God himself. And the teacher would say, you guys, you people who believe in God, you just believe in God because you're afraid of death. So you make up God as some kind of crutch, some kind of soothing feeling, you know, that because you're afraid of death, oh yes, but God will save me, like that. So he would ridicule like that. And when Virabhu told Prabhupada this on a morning walk, I think, in Los Angeles, He was telling him this, you know. Prabhupada stopped. So you know that Prabhupada, you know, has taken whatever it is, Prabhupada's taking this seriously, you know, because he actually stops his walk, you know. Of course, everybody stops with Prabhupada, you know. And Prabhupada looks up and looks over to Virabhahu and says, "Yes, and you tell him, you rascal, you get rid of death and then we'll stop making up God. You get rid of death. Death exists, it's real, it happens, and you're a fool not to be afraid of it. So if you get rid of death, or you scientists get rid of death, then we can stop making up God." So they're making the point that, you know, somehow or other people who are afraid of death, they're fools or sentimentalists like that. But death is a real thing. And who is brave enough to say, except for a devotee who is fully, as I was saying in those verses, who's fully conscious of Krishna and is fully in knowledge of Krishna, who would be foolish enough to say that there is no apprehension or no anxiety or no sense of trepidation about death? Only foolish people like that. But those foolish people exist. And we can become one of those foolish people as long as we're not vigilant in our practice of Krishna consciousness. And as I say, one of the best ways to become vigilant of that is by actually helping other people to become vigilant of that. People who, for whatever reason, are not as fortunate as us and have not, at this particular point in time, been able to connect with devotees and with spiritual life. And get them to understand, like I was saying, padam padam yad vipadam, danger at every step. So I'll tell that little story I was going to tell. This isn't related to devotees, but it's apparently a true story. At least it was presented as a true story. And some years ago, I think about 15 years ago, that kind of time, it was around the time that email had just started to become known and was becoming used. It wasn't rampant like now that you can do emails on your mobile phone. I mean, you'll be able to do emails in your mind soon, you know. Someone will just send you an email, you know, through telepathy or whatever, you know, and you'll respond through whatever. But this was in the early days, you know, when mobile phones were like about that long, you know, and that wide and that thick, and people used to have a, you know, a support system to hold them. So this was just at the beginning days when email was just starting to come into vogue. And there was this couple in North America, and they're in one of those northern states. I think it was Minneapolis or Minnesota or one of those places where they have very cold winters. And actually now I've thought of another story actually also related to the purport, which I might also tell. Anyway, they're in one of these really cold states. And they were a very successful couple. The husband had his own business, and it was a very successful business, and the wife was a professional. I think she was a doctor or a surgeon or something like that. So they were very, very wealthy people. But as is often the case with people like that, wealthy people, successful people, their lives are very, very hectic and very, very busy, and they get very little time to themselves. And they apparently hadn't had a holiday in many years, something like 10 years or something, they hadn't had a holiday. And because of the particularly cold weather, they just decided on the spot, that's it. In a couple of weeks, we're just going to get away for a week, and we're just going to have a break, and we're just going to do it. So they did it. So the husband, he booked a hotel, a really fancy hotel down in Florida. Florida, for those of you who don't know, most of you I'm sure do, but Florida is one of these places that's always warm. It's always warm. You know, it never gets cold. It's a bit like India, actually. Never gets cold. So they booked a really fancy Dan, as we say in English, a fancy Dan hotel in Florida that had, like, you know, a big leisure center and sport. It had a jacuzzi in the bathroom and, you know, really, really fancy hotel. And he'd made all the arrangements. Now, unfortunately, his wife, she couldn't come on the same flight with him because she had one more operation to do before she could get free. So he flew down a day earlier than his wife to Florida. And they're coming from freezing cold. It was snow, packed ice on the streets like that in this Minnesota or Minneapolis, wherever it was. So freezing cold place. So he flew down, and he arrived in the hotel, and he checked the hotel out. And it was really nice hotel. Everything was perfect, and the staff were wonderful. The facilities were great, and the weather was lovely, and everything was just perfect. He was so excited, because it was their first holiday in 10 years, that he decided to send his wife an email. Now, he didn't have a laptop, or certainly didn't have an email, you know, but the hotel computer. You could send emails from the hotel computer. And this was a kind of a novel thing, you know. In fact, I think in the story it says it was going to cost him something like $35 to send the email. So, it, you know, it was a very new, novel kind of thing. Anyway, so he goes on the computer and he writes to his wife. And he just says, oh, everything's wonderful here. Everything's been arranged for you coming here tomorrow. You don't have to worry about a thing. Wonderful facilities. You know, we're all looking forward, especially me, to greeting you. And all stuff like that. And then at the end he said, P.S., it's friggin' hot down here. Because he was letting her know that it's really cold up there. It's friggin' hot down. He really emphasized how hot it was down in Florida. But then he had to manually type in her email because, you know, obviously his wife's email wasn't on the system. Or it wasn't even his wife's email. It was her work email, I think. It wasn't on the system. So he manually typed it in and he sent it. But he got one digit wrong, or one dot, or one underscore, or one something. He got one little thing wrong. So, of course, his wife didn't receive the email. Meanwhile, in another part of the U.S., somewhere in the west in the U.S., there was a lady who was relatively, she was a mature lady, but still relatively young, about 50 years of age. And she was married to a vicar. And the vicar, her husband, had just died. He had died a few days before this. And she was at the ceremony in the church for his funeral. And it was very well attended because he was the local vicar and it was very popular. And she had just come home, or back to the presbytery or whatever it was, from the ceremony. And she also went on the church's computer. And she also decided, just to check email, just to make sure, because she was thinking that maybe some people have sent condolences and their respects for her husband. And she was, you know, she was in a mourning kind of thing. So she checked on the email, and this email that this man sent to his wife with that one thing wrong just happened to be this lady's email. So she downloaded the email, and she read it. And it said, "Hello, dear. I've arrived safely. Everything is in place for you tomorrow for your arrival here. I'm really looking forward to seeing you. Feels like forever since we've been together. So everything's in place. Can't wait. P.S. It's friggin' hot down here." So sorry. Huh? Well, what? And she was totally distressed, and she had a heart attack on the spot and died on the spot. Padam padam yad vipadam. I don't know how, you know, I don't know. You know, these bookmakers, the gambling shops, they do all these odds. You know, you can get, you know, 1,000,000 to 1 and 10,000,000 to 1 and 1 to 1,000,000 and all these different odds that they do. I don't know what the odds would be for that, you know, her husband dying and these people going on holiday and just having the same email address at one dot, just different, and at the exact same time he sends that, she downloads and she reads that. I mean, it just must be so incredibly. So padam padam yad vipadam. We may think we're young and fit and healthy and all of these things, but at any moment, anything can happen in the material world, you know. And that's why Prabhupada said, you know, one of his famous phrases was that real philosophy means to always keep death right in front of you. Non-devotees will tell us that that's such a morbid outlook, such a morbid viewpoint. But real death means to always keep, oh sorry, real philosophy means to always keep death right in front of us, that we're aware that at any moment that can happen. I was going to talk a little bit more about something else, but I'm looking at the time already and it's already pushing on. So maybe I will just tell this one other story. and then maybe take some questions and maybe talk a little more, maybe go into that other subject matter. But it is 9:20. So one of the quick stories going to tell, just about the scientist. Prabhupada uses this phrase, the blind leading the blind. And here we have Durvasa Muni, who, if we all followed him, we would take extreme offense at the most ridiculous thing. You know, could you imagine Durvasa Muni living now, you know, in our modern world? You know, he would take offense, you know, every minute of every day, you know, that someone just, you know, whatever, walks in front of you and bumps you, or, you know, doesn't offer you due respect, or whatever it may be, you know, it's like he'd be taking offense at every moment of every day. So, and then the scientists, they're trying to convince us, you know, that all this is bogus, it's all rubbish, you know, and God doesn't exist. And what's their philosophy? What's their philosophy as a result? Enjoy yourself. You only live once. One of the most unfortunate phrases in the English language that caught on like wildfire. It's such a common phrase that people use. Asha, you only live once. I mean, it's just rampant. You know, people just use it all the time. It's like, no, you don't. No, you got it wrong. You know, it's such an unfortunate thing, because the implication is, as Prabhupada used the phrase, eat, drink, and be merry, like that. Enjoy yourself, enjoy your senses. And of course, as devotees, we know all the complications that lead once you accept that philosophy, all the problems that just flow from that. All the problems you identify this body as the self, you identify the mind as the self. You then get absorbed in false ego. You then, take offense at the slightest thing. When we have the example, of course, in the Bhagavatam, many examples, but we have the wonderful example in the Srimad Bhagavatam of Dharma, the personification, personality of religion, that has been attacked by Kali, mutilated by Kali. Kali's chopping three of his limbs off like that. And then when Maharaj Parikit comes and asks, who did this to you? With Kali still in the vicinity, with Maharaj Parikit even already knowing actually that it was Kali, but he just wanted Dharma to give a positive affirmation that it was actually Kali that had done this. And then what does Dharma eventually say? It's very difficult to ascertain the cause of your suffering. And I think he gives 17 different possibilities of philosophical possibilities of what was the cause of his suffering, like that. And basically the point being that, you know, he's not pointing the finger. Why? Because he's completely off the bodily platform, and therefore, you know, we only defend ourselves and defend like that if we're in bodily consciousness and on the bodily platform. What an amazing thing that you've just been mutilated. You know, it's difficult enough for us not to defend ourselves. It's virtually impossible for us not to defend ourselves when we actually know we're not in the wrong. So, if I'm leaving the Chaupati temple this morning, going back to Juhu, and let's say for the time that I was here, you know, I don't know, you know, a lakh of rupees was stolen from the treasury. And somebody says, oh yes, you know, but that time when Pragosh said he was going to the bathroom, actually he ran into the treasury office and he stole that lakh of rupees. And of course I didn't. I was in the bathroom, you know, and I'm totally innocent in that sense. And then Gauranga Prabhu comes to me and says, Pragosh, sorry, you can't leave. You can't go back to Juhu to your meeting. Sorry. You're on trial now because, you know, we think that you stole that lakh of rupees. You know, for me not to defend myself in that situation is it, for me to be like Dharma and say, it's very difficult to ascertain. It's very difficult to ascertain who stole that lakh of rupees. No, but, you know, that will be very, very difficult for me to, when you're in the wrong. But even when in Kali Yuga, even when we're in the wrong, even when people are in the wrong, they still defend themselves to the hilt. And that's why, I'm not sure the exact system in India, but that's why in the West, the criminal justice system, You have people who everybody knows are as guilty as hell. You know, everybody knows they're guilty, they did it. Yet they get free legal aid, they get solicitors and lawyers who the state, the taxpayer, pays thousands and thousands and thousands of pounds and euros and dollars to defend the person like that, when everyone knows they were guilty. All because of this propensity to defend. We want to defend ourselves like that. So, and Prabhupada says in some of those purports, just to quickly mention, he says, if you point the finger, even if, quote unquote, it's justified, but the point is, it's not our position, actually. In this case, it was Maharaj Parikit's position as the king. It's his position to administer justice like that. And if we get into the blame game, I think Prabhupada uses that phrase, the blame game, and we're pointing the finger, and there's enmity in our heart when we're doing it, a sense of revenge, a sense of, you know, even hatred towards the person. Prabhupada explains that we then will be the recipient of the same karmic reaction as the actual perpetrator of the crime. So this, you know, this. So that's the kind of the pre-making up. That's the kind of Durvasa Muni mentality. And now I will finish on that little story, just to the blind leading the blind. And this is why we always should be very careful who we are taking instruction from. And in that sense, there's no safer person to take instruction from than His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. It's just, he came, you know, from birth we understand he was a pure devotee. His whole life was mapped out to serve Lord Chaitanya's mission in the most incredible way, to actually bring it from the shores of Bharat Varsh all over the world, the Senapati Bhakta. The service that he did, which intensified at the age of 69. I'm 49. I'm 20 years younger than when Prabhupada left India to go to India. And, you know, I know when I sit up from here after finishing speaking, that's another reason I don't want to go on too long, you know. It'll take sort of 5 minutes for my knee joints to sort of realize that they work again, you know. And I'm 20 years younger. 69, Prabhupada set sail, you know, to the West. And what did he do in those 11 years that he was with us in the West? Oh, he spread the Hare Krishna movement, translated all of these books without any scintilla of motivation or wanting something back. He didn't come to the West to charge his disciples, you know, or to sell his books at a profit so he can make a big fat bank balance. He just did it as the servant of his spiritual master and a servant of the previous acharyas and a servant of Lord Chaitanya, a servant of Krishna. Why? Because people are suffering, and he wanted to help them from their suffering condition. So they're the people we should follow. People who have no motivation. Not these people who have motivation and ulterior motives. So this principle of the blind leading the blind. So I'll finish on this story, short story. Again, another true story. I've told a few times, so some may have heard this story. I'm particularly thinking of my dear friend, Haridas Prabhu. So bear with us. But it just really illustrates blind leading the blind. And Prabhupada, what did Prabhupada say when he blind leads the blind? They fall into the ditch. So this isn't falling into the ditch, but it's the equivalent. So in North America, actually it was in Canada, which is North America, sorry, no need to apologize, I didn't say the USA. In North America, Canada, some years ago, not that long ago, it was only a couple of years ago, it was around this time of year. A little earlier, so end of September, beginning of October. And it was the beginning of the winter season is starting to come into play. And there's this Native American tribe. For those of you who don't know, I'm sure you all do know, I'm probably just displaying my ignorance, but for those of you who don't know, when we say Native Americans, it's what we used to refer to as Red Indians, which we're not meant to use that term anymore because that's apparently, I think, like calling an Irishman a paddy. It's a little derogatory. So Native Americans. So there was this Native American tribe in Canada, and they had their chief, the chief of the tribe, or tribe is okay, Panchrana, to use that phrase? That's okay? Pa? Or nation? Oh, they call themselves, each group calls themselves a nation. Well, that's interesting. Okay. So this nation, what we would formally have called a tribe, but we call nation, they had the same chief. They'd had the same chief for many, many years. I think something like 70 years. He was in his 90s, and he had been their chief since he was in his 20s. So they had the same chief for 70 years. And he had died just around this time, a few weeks before this story. And of course, when he died, they had to install a new chief. And the new chief, whatever way it worked, the new chief was a chap, a young chap in his late 20s or early 30s, and he was just a young chap. The old chief, he had carried with him all of the many skills and arts and knowledge that his predecessors had given him. So they're very skilled at being able to sort of put their finger in the air and feel what way the wind's blowing, to judge weather, or to touch the ground and feel the moisture and know what's happening, or to see the stars or the clouds or whatever, and they'd be able to tell many things from those kind of natural phenomena like that. The new fella actually knew little or practically nothing about those things. The skills were kind of lost. He was more akin to playing PlayStation and, you know, doing stuff like that and emailing and whatever else. But now he was the chief. He'd become the chief. So it was around the end of September, beginning of October, and the other people of the nation, they wanted to know what the winter was going to be like. Because if it was going to be a mild winter, then there was no problem. But if it was going to be a heavy winter, then they'd really need to make sure they had ample firewood, etc. So they went to the new chief, and they said to him, "Chief, what kind of winter is it going to be?" Now, the new chief knew what they were asking and why they were asking, but he also knew he hadn't got a clue. But then he also thought he has a responsibility as the leader, as the chief, to help his people. Jai Shishi Radha Gopinath Ki. He also knew he had a responsibility to help his people. So therefore, he speculated. And he said, and then we all know speculation is a dangerous thing, and he said, "Well, you know, to the best of my knowledge, based on whatever skills I've learned from our predecessor chief, who was related to him, and also a few other little things, I think it's going to be a bad winter. But I will do a little more study, I'll confirm with you later, but I think it's going to be a bad winter." So on the basis of that, they went out and they started to collect firewood for the winter. In the meantime, later on that day, the chief rang the local Met office, because he didn't know, so he wanted to get some advice on people who hopefully would know something. So he rang the local weather station or Met office, and he asked them, he says, "Are you predicting a bad winter this year?" And the chap on the phone says, "Oh, give me a minute." And he went off and he came back and he said, "Well, actually, yes. Our prediction is that it is going to be a bad winter, because we haven't had a bad winter for 3 or 4 years now. And usually at least every 3 or 4 years we have a bad winter. So yes, we think it's going to be a bad winter." So the chief now was bolstered with his original speculation, and he got some kind of confirmation from the Met office. So he went back to his people, and then when he saw them, the subject came up again, or even he introduced it, and he says, "Yes, actually, it's going to be a bad winter this year, so we better get prepared for it." So they went out then the next days, and they even renewed vigor, and they chopped and collected lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of firewood, you know. About a week later, the chief thought, "Better just check with the Met office again, just make sure they haven't changed," because they do tend to change, "make sure they haven't changed their mind." So they rang up the Met office again, and the Met office basically gave them the same information. "Yes, actually, we're hardening our view. We think it's going to be quite a tough winter." So he went back to his people again, and he told them again, "We really need to focus on this now. The winter's closing in, and we really need to get a huge amount of firewood in." So they went out again, and they collected like crazy, like the proverbial ants, you know, really working super, super hard, collecting loads and loads of firewood. So then for a final time, about a week or so again later, about a final time, the chief thought he'll ring the Met office one more time just to absolutely confirm it. So he rang again, and he said, "Yes, just calling again. Just want to know, are you still of the view that it's going to be a very hard winter?" And they says, "Yes, absolutely. We think it's going to be one of the hardest winters in living memory." And he says, "Okay, thank you very much." And he says, "By the way, how can you be so sure that it's going to be such a hard winter?" And he says, Well, we kind of thought it ourselves, but we're absolutely convinced now because the Native Americans are collecting firewood like crazy. So when he heard that, his heart just sank. I thought, oh my God, what have I done? You know, those people are going out, they're collecting firewood. So anyway, the blind leading the blind. And you know, because of our tendency to either speculate or because of our tendency to think we're more intelligent than we are, because of many different tendencies that we have, not just us, but the living entities, human beings in general, there are millions of opportunities for people to be led by blind people. On the basis, as I say, of people thinking they're more intelligent than they are, people just being stupid, people being speculators, whatever. So we have to be very, very careful, you know. Like that phrase, everything you read in the paper doesn't mean that it's true, you know. And ultimately, you know, truth really exists in the books given to us by Srila Prabhupada and the previous acharyas. Thank you all very, very much. If there are any questions or comments, I can take one or two, I think, and then I think we have to finish. Yes, Peru.
Hare Krishna. Thank you for the very nice class.
Thank you.
You said you're 49, and actually I'm amazed to hear that you are actually so young. So it's his 31st disappearance of Srila Prabhupada. So you must be below 18 when you got...
No. What was your first thing you said, that you're 49 and you're amazed what?
That this 31st year of Prabhupada disappearance. So you must be initiated by Srila Prabhupada when you... Sorry.
No, I didn't take initiation from... I was one of those unfortunate people who didn't get Srila Prabhupada's Vapu, but one of those fortunate people who got his Vani, which we understand to be equally, if not more important than the Vapu Association. So sometimes we think like that, as I presume most of you here sitting here are not disciples of Srila Prabhupada, direct disciples of Srila Prabhupada. But, you know, it's really no disadvantage whatsoever, you know, in us practicing our spiritual life, no disadvantage whatsoever. If anything, it can almost be an advantage. And when we think about it, I'm not sure of the official figure. Sometimes we oscillate sometimes between 5,000 and 10,000 people who took initiation from Prabhupada. Wow. Right. That's the official figure? Okay. So less than 5,000. So as you point out, I don't think any of them are 49, right? Do we have any who are 49? Did that devotee, Dwarkadish, did he take initiation from Prabhupada? The Gurukul boy? He got his name, but he didn't take formal initiation. I think, well, leaving him aside, I doubt there are any Prabhupada disciples who are under 50, actually, direct disciples. I think Radhanath Maharaj actually would quite possibly be one of the younger ones. I think Radhanath Maharaj is 55? 60. Oh, he's 60. Oh, okay. And Pancharatna, you're 60 this year as well. So there you go. I think it's very unlikely. What age were you when you joined? And what age were you? So he joined when he was 19 in 1970, and he's 60 this year. So let's say somebody joined when they were 18 in 66. That means they'd be 55 this year. I think it's very unlikely that there are any direct Prabhupada disciples who are under 50. I think it's very unlikely. Under 50. Very unlikely. So in 50 years' time, there will be no direct disciples of Srila Prabhupada with us on the planet. Oh, very unlikely that there will be any direct disciples of Srila Prabhupada with us on the planet living. But the Hare Krishna movement will go on. It will go on. And one of the most disappointing things to Srila Prabhupada would be if it didn't go on. So it will be his grand disciples and his great-grand disciples and his great-great-grand disciples that will continue the legacy that he started. And just as Srila Prabhupada, if you go back to Jagannath Das Babaji, etc., who Prabhupada would never have met. It's like and Bhaktivinoda Thakur, etc. You know it's actually inconsequential. In that sense, it's inconsequential. The most important thing is that we're carrying on their mission, carrying on their legacy like that. Okay, anyone else? Any question or comment? Okay, thank you all very, very much. It was very nice to be back here at ISKCON Chowpatty, and I hope it's not as long before I come back again. Thank you all very much. Hare Krishna. Jai. Srila Prabhupada ki. Srimad Bhagavatam ki.
So let us express our gratitude to His Grace Prabhupada Prabhu by loudly chanting. So again, to remind, this evening there is Prerna Festival.